Now we are coming to very interesting topic, transition from mythical to mental, and he gives three different ways or three different modes of thinking. Oceanic thinking could be described as the oceanic circling, reminiscent of mythical image. It is a form of thought closely tied to the mythical structure. Pyramidal logic thinking is the efficient form of mental, rational, conceptual thinking, of which the perspectival spatial thinking is a deficient form. We will come to it. And paradoxical thinking is like a residue of mythical and magic in the mental structure. Now, oceanic thinking, what is this? In the beginning, A, beginning was the word, B. And the word B was with God, C. And God, C, was the word B. The same word B was in the beginning, A. Now we can see that it is a process of self-contemplation, and the central concept here, circumscribed rather than described, is God. A, B, B, C, C, B, B, A. So C is kind of embraced by this structure and gives it a sense of presence. The fact that oceanic thinking circumscribes something is a valid demonstration that the mythical circular world has a content. By destroying the circle with the directed thinking, man, to the extent that he is a mental being, mental man, has lost this content. By breaking through, as Athena broke through the head of Zeus, in the same manner, we lost the content. We come out to some other world where there is no content. For space is without content.
It's like a small chicken.
Yes, chicken born into a bigger world. The lack of content, which initially appears as openness, became obvious in the deficient rational phase of the mental structure. Later we will come to this. This openness has been described as emptiness. And indeed, since then it is emptiness. And we can feel the emptiness of our life, though we have everything, and there is nothing we can do about it. For that reason, any mere description is today empty or non-committal. In this sense, descriptions are rational, flattened, and quantified attributions that initially had a mental value and made our conceptual world possible. Now, initially they had values, and now they lost their values, finally. They are quantified. The quality of the mythical experience and the life of the magic structure was quantified and presented to us, as we were mentioning that we are presenting presentations. It's also a presentation today, without which we cannot perceive anymore somehow. We need this presentation. Our mind is to be engaged. So Heraclitus says, it's interesting, for souls it is death to become water, for water it is death to become earth. But from the earth comes water, and from water soul. Now we see clear this oceanic thinking. Earth, soul becomes water, water becomes earth, but earth becomes water, and water becomes soul. It is all rotating around death as a concept. It explains death in its rotation of embodiment of the soul and appearance of embodiment in matter. It's an example of that. Pyramidal thinking. We are coming to our closer thinking, and that appears with these kind of premises. First premise is, all men are mortal. It's well known in the logic. Second premise is, Socrates is a man. And conclusion, therefore, Socrates is mortal. And you can see clearly that this pyramid, man is Socrates, Plato, others, lower one. Then there is a higher pyramid over it. Mortal is man and animals and other creatures. So if Socrates is man and man is mortal, then Socrates is mortal. Simple, clear, no more discussions. Done, finished, no inquiries.
Wonderful.
Wonderful, simple.
Now we can think.
Now, finally, we can have something concrete in our hand. Concrete, which will become concrete later. Because before it was only this, you know, thing. But how do you feel about it?
It's not just a joke, though. Because,
it's not a joke.
Gebser points out that this is the emergence of the philosophy, the way of thinking. So that's what's emerging from Heraclitus on is thinking. And then philosophy is just thinking about thinking. And that's what we've been living for the last few millennia.
Right. I fully agree with this. In especially in perspective of emergence of integral structure, it makes full sense. As it is becoming deficient, and he will show the deficient forms of this structure. First of all, it is not complete because there is one more above something, yes? Creatures, and he puts it there, to which the pyramidal thinking somehow is not related and does not reach to the fourth reflection. Now, we have only three reflections, but we don't have the fourth one. The creatures are of two kinds, mortal and immortal. So it can be, if Socrates is finally a creature, that he might be also immortal. Don't you think so?
Well, Aristotle thought so.
Yeah.
But we must think so.
Well, if you didn't.
The mind is still, for the philosopher, the mind is still the infinite and eternal, without which there is no other. So there's always behind philosophical thinking the assumption of the archaic, just as there is behind all the other, but it disappears. That archaic or magic or mythical structure disappears in the new structure.
Right.
But
right.
It's still there.
Yes.
It's always there.
Yes. So this magic is now rationally formulated. Those relations in the nature, which were before not clearly seen by the ego sense, now finally can be defined in the mind by the mental structure. Yeah? Deficiency of pyramidal logic, he gives in this example. A man fell into the water, especially we go from general to particular, yes? We are all men, consequently we all fall into the water. And it's quite interesting that it doesn't work directly, but it's interesting that we all fall into the water as a possibility.
Many people think like this.
Yes. Especially in our world.
It's quite deficient.
If pyramidal logic of Plato made us visualize a vertically constructed world, and this is quite interesting because he starts with the matter and ends with the heaven, and he gives us spatially visible all the levels of our kind of inner and outer existence, that is his first philosophy. Kant's dualism, on the other hand, where appearances confront cognition and reason as their object, and the thing in itself is to be sought behind the appearances, presupposes a horizontal arrangement of basic concepts and their content. There is surely a basic distinction between Platonic and Kantian philosophy, inasmuch as Kant's ideas no longer reside above man, but are points of orientation lying in the same plane with man. Now this was the whole redirection. From here we move towards what we know as classical German philosophy and Hegel's definition final of the dialectic thinking is coming from there. it's no more pyramidal in a sense, of Platonic sense. But there is thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. But this has made thinking itself spatial and static, permitting the materialization of spirit and even the spatialization of time. Now, paradoxical thinking. The bond which diuresis, or this division, has severed, a bond which man dispenses with only at the peril of denying a part of himself, the irrational, that mythical perception, cannot be restored either by pyramidal or even less by perspectival thought. It cannot be restored, that bond, that relation. Yet, it is possible to propose a previously unrecognized form of thought that reveals the covalidity of the irrational in a form reminiscent of a rational mode of formation. We have called this thought form paradoxical and described paradoxical statement as preeminent form of religious utterance. From the mental point of view, paradoxical thinking actually establishes the bond of religio to the irrationality of pre-rationality of the mythical and magic structures. It is a form that mediates between the oceanic and perspectival thinking and contains both rational and irrational elements. A good example of paradoxical expression is the well-known statement of Pascal, "You would not seek me if you had not found me." It destroys the pyramid. There is no pyramid. "You would not seek me if you had not found me." Does it make sense? Makes sense? They are shifted cause and effect. They are not in the same plane, the same relation.
No, it's an intuition. Trying to put the intuition in right. Correspondence with the rational definition. If you didn't already know it, you couldn't learn it.
Yes.
If you were not already rooted in being, then you couldn't know that world in which you are.
Right.
It's also a perfect integration. This Kepserian observation is a perfect integration of the Heideggerian phenomenological development.
And it expresses the polarity which we had before. It's expressive.
Yes. Yes, he gives that such a schema, very interesting. Whatever lies beyond the spatial perspectival point in infinity, that is, in the immeasurable, verifies in its image what is posited in irrational terms as a result. In other words, a statement of irrational character in the rational sphere has in the irrational structure a rational character.
Good example of the inception of the integral. It's beginning to show itself.
Yeah, it's beautiful, anyway. That is beyond and on the other side of the point, behind the specializing horizon. This reestablishes in an unusual, clever, and effective manner the bond or religio to the past. So it can be done, even in rational terms. It can come to the rationality and touch it in some way. It can give some kind of transparency or emerge into transparency later, this particular way of thinking. Now, he goes on, of course, the three most familiar statements on thought and thinking. Thinking and being is one and the same, Parmenides. The statement equates, giving moderation and balance. Then we have thinking is calculation in words, Hobbes. The measuring aspect of thinking, its quality has been changed to a quantity, by the pluralizing inherent in the statement as well as by the numerical calculation. So calculation in words, thinking. Hobbes lived at the same time as Descartes, no? The same, the beginning of 17th century. I think, therefore, I am. Here, the isolated thinking by an individual is alone valid, and the spatial being of Parmenides becomes to be identified as a consequence of thinking with the being of a person. Actually, Aristotle already did that, by the way. Descartes just reinforced it. It is already there in Aristotle. Now, the formation of the ego in the mental structure. Descartes, with his cogito, I think, no, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Descartes, with his cogito, I think, transposes the action or movement confirming or substantiating the existence of the ego essentially from the psychic vital realm into the psychic mental. And it's a good definition, by the way. And this is merely a kind of hypergradation that does not eliminate ergo, therefore, sum I am. So it doesn't, you do not become, you kind of add to it. You enlarge something which was there in the mythical structure, and it is not yet fully cutting you off, as it should. The fact that such varied interpretations are possible, such varied interpretations of philosophies, different philosophies and philosophers speak nearly about the same thing in different ways. And these sayings and these philosophies are valid when you come to them. You can criticize every philosophy from the point of view of any other philosophy, but if you come to that philosophy deeply, you will see that it is as valid as any other philosophy. And it is a puzzling thing. How come we do not have one structure which would permit us to know the truth? We have many different approaches to truth. So the fact that such varied interpretations are possible at all and remain at variance and remain not disappearing, Aristotle is still there and still studied. Even if we take into account the particular definitions of each individual philosopher, can be explained if we remember that all such axioms are in part determined by the psyche. Psyche is there at the background. It is psyche which makes those particularities in definitions and approaches. In the rarefied air of abstraction, look at this, they regain a certain ambiguity and equivocation inherent in the psyche. These statements become psychic statements. I think, therefore, I exist, becomes something ambiguous. It's not clear what it is. It has its own life. It gains its own validity, which is not from rational structure. The psyche gives its own validity from within. They regain a certain ambiguity and equivocation inherent in the psyche. How could this not be true also of Descartes, who limits his inquiry in his discourse on the method to the rationalistic calculation of the verities, the truths alone? How can you make this rationalistic calculation of verities if you would not have the psyche influence? Impossible. Makes sense. Now I'm finishing my presentation. It's the last slide, and we will go for tea. And it's very important intuition and discovery. Here we can discern the tragic aspect of the deficient mental structure. Reason, reversing itself metabolistically to an exaggerated rationalism, becomes a kind of inferior plaything of the psyche. neither noticing nor even suspecting the connection. Although the convinced rationalist will be unwilling to admit it, there is, after all, the rational distorted image of the speculatio animae and speculatio rationis, a kind of shadow boxing before a mirror whose reflection occurs against the blind surface. This negative link to the psyche, usurping the place of the genuine mental relation, destroys the very thing achieved by the authentic relation, the ability to gain insight into the psyche, the ability to get a sight, to look into the psyche, to see what is what, is destroyed by this mixture, the rational mixture with the psyche influence. It creates this ego structure. That's why what philosopher said is right, and that can be criticized by this philosophy and that philosophy, and all these clashes and all these debates in our AV council, all these endless stories which are rationally sounding true but have that element of subjective psyche influence which gives them force to be exclusively true against any other view, does not permit us to see the real thing. Doesn't make sense. I think this is a very crucial contribution of Goetze. In every extreme rationalization, there is not just a violation of the psyche by the ratio, that is a negatively magic element, but also the graver danger. Graver because of its avenging and incalculable nature. That dark side of nature which we do not know may come in. The violation of the ratio by the psyche, where both become deficient. The authentic relation of the psyche, the mental, is perverted into its opposite, to the disadvantage of the ego that has become blind through isolation. Now, because this ego is supported by the psyche truth from within and uses the mental structure in thinking, it is completely bewildered and it does not distinguish what forces it introduces. And there are other forces which may enter, and they entered, and he is referring to the Third Reich here, these forces of darkness which enter in and possess this blind psyche, of this blind ego, isolated ego. Because of this assertion coming from the psyche to this.
This word psyche.
It's his word.
Yes, it's very interesting because again it's like more than one thing.
Yes.
And many different meanings. So it's hard to pin it down when you first use the word psyche to actually understand what it means. Because I can take in one way it's a level of, it's a dimension of inferiority. He's speaking, which is also a level of, you could say, primordiality. It's more close to the origin. But I could also relate to perhaps certain movements of the vital on the surface, which
he distinguishes.
Hijack the mental, so to speak, for his own purposes. So, do you see that?
No, he distinguishes between psyche and the vital magic perception structure. And that is the valid distinction, because psyche for him is of really true origin. I mean, that kind of element of the truth which wants to reveal itself in individual terms, yeah? The soul. The soul is different from vital and physical magic structure and experience. And that difference is, again, you see, we are emerging from the magic structure of this kind of basics of food, sex, all these forces of nature, of vital and physical nature, yes, which are components of our being, then the emergence of psyche is of the soul, which is confronting them, which does not want to play that role and wants to go back to the origin, in spite of them being there. It is contradictory to the layout of the magic structure. And then we have on the top, the psyche, mental structure, which repeats this magic in another reverse terms of objectivity. And we have this magic world outside us. We are magic creatures. We deny the existence of our soul. We see it only in terms of ego sense, in terms of magic structure again.
So, in a sense, there is no right relation between the mental and the psyche. Always deficient.
There is always deficient. There is always struggle between our, you're absolutely right, between our psyche. So that's why it's close to the psychic. There is always the fight between the psychic and the lower nature, yes? Mother says there is an abyss between the sexual desire and the love or the aspiration of the soul. They are of two different natures. They have nothing in common. But we are tending to identify them because we have a mental structure on the top, which tells us that the magic is soul's magic. No, it's not soul's magic. It's magic of the magic. Mythical is necessary, the soul is necessary, right. That's what Mother says, the emergence of psychic is the most important thing for the whole thing. Without it, nothing is possible. Because it alone knows the truth. All the rest is just instrumentation or field of application, if you like. Yes, it is there, it is valid, but not in terms of the truth yet. The psychic has to bring that force and make it true.
I think what this discussion that's going on right now is to go into the category that Kepser calls sectorial thinking. We are trying to see what the relationship is. We're trying to understand rationally what the relationship is between these major intensities of consciousness that have been identified. And so to try to separate the physical and the vital and the mental is a sectorial way of thinking. But it isn't going to actually show us the answer to the question that's being asked.
Because all thinking is deficient.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, thinking itself isn't deficient as long as it is a movement of consciousness to stand in the presence of truth, but then it's not really capable of doing that fully, and so it begins to break things down and conceptualize and then analyze and then calculate and so on. So that's totally legitimate, it's just that it's not capable of ever completing the task of consciousness. And I think Gebser often doesn't distinguish very explicitly between the physical and the vital. For example, the magical is for him is often identified with the physical.
Vital.
Yeah. But if the psychic for him, if the psyche is the primordial, if it's like pre-archaic. If it's so indistinguishable from matter that it's somehow at the origin, if it is the origin, then we have a conception that's closer to Sri Aurobindo's point of view. But Gebser is not speaking about cosmic metaphysics. He's speaking about the emergence of consciousness. And so he is, and that in a way is a problem with that we might come to at some point in understanding Gebser, that his vision is more limited to a kind of symbolic, historic representation of the human being. He's not going beyond that to the super cosmic totality. So his is still a view from below up. His is not a view from the totality down, I would say. And so it's difficult to clarify exactly for him what corresponds to the vital influence in manifestation as opposed to the psychic influence in manifestation, because they're still emerging.
But this is to me then the interesting thing, because what we're doing, we try each individual also to sort out
right.
what we understand of Debsa and what his way of wording means to me in relationship to my philosophical or experiential context. And I think therefore it's very permissible that Rob will say in one breath, like, he's not very distinct and clear. And you might be saying he's very distinct and clear. All that indicates is there's still a lot of subjectivity.
It's always there.
That we're working through. And I think that's also what he allows.
Yes.
And for me, it's just a question of, well, how do we understand the word psyche? And yet we are healthy, actually, that. So maybe there was a solution which sounds.
We can see in ourselves, even subjectively, that we have always a contradiction between three parts in us. There is the heart part in us, that soul thing. There is the being, the body, with its demands of survival and pleasure and comforts of the magic structure, the needs of the nature. And there is the mental, which is always in contradiction to the soul rather than to the body. Less to the body than to the soul. Between the soul and mental, there is something ongoing for a long time. And Sri Aurobindo speaks about it in the Life Divine, that these two, this is the major contradiction in man's psychology. The difficulty that they are not united, the mind and the heart. They are always in contradiction. We have this contradiction in a discussion of Peter His book. It's exactly that contradiction of the mind and the heart. Their fight, their non-unity, the mental structure which is still reflecting the needs of the nature is not giving way for the soul to emerge. It has its own kind of structure. Objective magic world. It wants to keep it like this. It likes it. You know all this kind of world in which we live. And look at these what is being proposed to us. All these survival things, pleasure things, comfort, money. Look at these three powers of money, sex and power. And you will immediately understand that it emerges from the magic structure into the mental, straight away. And the soul is confronted with these great powers, suppressed, presented as an ego. Now, I wanted to, just to finish, you want to say?
I'm not very well versed in Debsa, but I understood somewhere that you also hints at he's taking this up as an arbitrary sort of like differentiation between the basic various levels. But I think he also says something like he could have easily arbitrarily added a couple of levels in between, but it makes it more complex.
This I don't know.
Maybe we can talk that question first.
Yes.
It's not so simple. It's not.
So what I wanted to end with it was that Sri Aurobindo also recognized the partial character of the validity of mental inquiry. The mind can justify any position. So I'm referring this to this, that every philosophy is valid as a system of thinking because of psyche presence in it. So, and I just suddenly remembered what Sri Aurobindo said. He lost all his interest in mind when he saw that you can justify by mind any position. What does it mean, really? It means that psyche will choose, actually, where to go and what to justify, what kind of magic it wants to have. And it will be as valid as anybody else's magic or anybody else's thinking. Yes, the relativeness of mental formulation of truth, because there is a need of the psyche there. And even Mother Binu Mukherjee was here, the scientist, And he met with the mother. He grew up in the ashram, and he said he discussed with her issues of science. And she said, yes, science should be objective, more and more objective. And she complained that they are not objective enough for the science. So what they do, they become objective till the certain moment when they get some formulation and some vision, and then they dwell on it. It becomes ambiguous. It becomes something unclear. It becomes a statement of the psyche, the belief. It builds up a belief system. That's what science does. And she complained against that, saying that they are not objective enough. If they would be objective enough, they would find the truth. But they are stuck to certain preferences, likings and dislikings of the psyche to certain formulas and certain findings. That's the problem which we face in the mental structure.
There's a problem of the confusion between the psychic and the vital in terms of truth.
Right.
To say that preferences are psychic and not vital. There's an unclarity in these concepts, which I find coming all the way through his presentation. It's not a big problem, but it's there.
Yes. No, that is true. The impression of that he is not really distinguishing them in his exploration is true. But he has statements which are clearly putting in opposition these two structures. And once he does that, and he says that the emergence of the integral structure depends more on the mythical, the emergence of the soul, whereas there is a correlation between the magic and the mental, it suggests something which is of that further studies of Sri Aurobindo, which we are taking already from him. Yes. So here we stop. And we will continue our discussion at 11:15 after already 11:30 after the tea.
Thank you.